This message comes from NPR sponsor Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Stamps.com. When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
This is another bonus episode of Landslide. It's a production of Nuanced Tales in partnership with WFAE and distributed by the NPR Network. At one point, back in the mid-1800s, whale oil was the most prized fuel in America for lighting homes. It led to a whole industry of commercial whaling, the novel Moby Dick, among other things. And I mention this only because of how antiquated whale oil is compared to our modern energy sources. Political campaigns, until the mid-1970s, ran on the equivalent of whale oil. The campaign finance before that era looks just as antiquated. And then, a sudden explosion of dollars, a radical change driven by law, technology, opportunism, and a little bit of happenstance. And it reshaped not just how campaigns raise money, but the essential fabric of our politics. Today, on this bonus episode of Landslide, we're looking at the fuel that runs our political campaigns, the path to today's money in politics, and how it shaped campaigns in ways we may not even think about. Historian Mark C. Johnson is a fellow at the Mansfield Center at the University of Montana, and he starts our conversation by laying out what campaign finance looked like back in the old whale oil days of the 1960s.
Well, if you're somebody like Lyndon Johnson, you go to the Texas oil companies. You go to the guys who financed Johnson's political career throughout the 1940s and 50s, and they hand over big checks, you know, relatively big checks. So a handful of benefactors would write the big checks, and you'd be off and running.
And then in 1974, the Watergate scandal topples Nixon, and it's not just the break-in at the Watergate Hotel. It's how he's paying for it.
Yeah, we always think about the Watergate scandal as being, as you say, built around the break-in of the Watergate complex, the Democratic National Headquarters in Washington, D.C., which it clearly was. But what was core in many ways, Watergate was a scandal about political money. And that's kind of gotten lost in all the intrigue and the characters that emerged during the investigations, et cetera. So the response in 1974 is Congress says, we've got to do something to rein this beast in before it really gets further out of hand. So it took a great scandal to create the legislation that passed in 1974 that created the Federal Elections Commission.
Yeah. So the Campaign Finance Reform Act of 1974 passes. And, you know, I am struck by going back and looking at quotes from the time and what people thought about at the time. You know, good government groups, John Gardner, who led Common Cause, has this kind of incredible quote about what the bill means.
This just means we're never, never, never going back to the old corrupt way of doing things, the thing that was destroying American politics.
It's obviously ironic to look at that today, but how did the Campaign Finance Reform Act, why did people think it was going to sort of solve the problems of not only Watergate, but other emerging problems about the amount of money in politics?
Well, at the 30,000-foot level, it attempted to restrict the amount of money that was flowing into political campaigns by limiting the amount of money individuals could contribute to an individual candidate or an unaffiliated committee, an independent campaign. And at the same time, it tried to place expenditure limits on how much could be spent by campaigns. So it was disclosure, it was limitation, and a system to police the practices.
It seems to me that there's an effort to redirect the flow of money. So instead of these sort of large donors kind of having a huge pipeline of money to be able to funnel in, it creates these two other pipelines. You need to get more small donations from people. There's also public money. So there's a public financing system that's also this sort of new conduit of dollars. Would you say that that's – and then, of course, the FEC, as you mentioned, is supposed to oversee all of this. Would you say that that's like a fair encapsulation?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think, again, the theory behind this particular approach was, as you suggest, to make candidates go out there and hustle for smaller contributions from a larger number of people, demonstrating, presumably, a broad base of support for what they were talking about trying to do. And at the same time, you know, restrict the amount of money that was being spent by these campaigns so that you didn't have one candidate just overwhelming the airwaves or direct mail or whatever the tactic might be, so that you could have a fairer system.
Well, so let's go back to this Campaign Finance Reform Act passes. It passes with bipartisan majority, and then it goes to Gerald Ford. He signs the bill, and now all of a sudden we have kind of with great fanfare this change that's going to prevent future Watergates. It's going to prevent this explosion of campaign money in politics. Not everybody's happy with it. What happens?
Well, you have one of the most fascinating Supreme Court cases, I think, in the history of the country, Buckley versus Vallejo, a really complicated but genuinely fascinating case if you can set aside the kind of pernicious consequences of the case, in my judgment. The 150-page opinion, one of the longest detailed opinions ever issued by the Supreme Court, was largely built around a First Amendment right that said restrictions on spending money in political campaigns are restrictions on free speech. So this is the first time that money in politics is really equated directly with First Amendment rights. And it basically takes the guts out of these reforms that had been passed in 1974.
The court didn't strike down all of the law's limits. The Buckley decision kept restrictions on what donors could give campaigns, but it removed the limits on what outside groups could spend.
So individuals are now free to spend as much as they wish privately, as long as they're not in cahoots with a candidate.
And there was another immediate effect, too. A bit of a side story that we didn't have time to get into in the main series, but I'll tell you now. The Buckley decision came down in January of 1976. That was the middle of the campaign season. Candidates had been running for months.
Ronald Reagan now has campaigned in 30 states by plane, by train, and by bus.
Suddenly, the way that every single person running could fund their campaign was thrown into flux. Lawyers pored over the court decision to see what was now allowed and what wasn't. And most importantly, the new agency in charge of distributing public funding, which all the campaigns were owed and waiting on, had been found to be illegal. The court said Congress had given itself too much power in controlling the FEC, and it needed to pass a new law to fix it before public dollars would go out. Campaigns had been counting on this money. They'd borrowed against it. And that picked winners and losers based on who was owed more and who needed it most desperately. One of the losers was the Reagan campaign. Here's Frank Donatelli, an outside advisor.
We actually entered the 1976 campaign hobbled because we couldn't get the federal subsidy. It's true that that also applied to President Ford, but he was the president. He had an easier time collecting contributions than we did.
Reagan was more than $1 million in debt, a big sum at the time. He waited for the funds. Congress finally passed a fix, and it reached the desk of his opponent.
When the president signs that law, the money will start to flow again.
Gerald Ford, perhaps unsurprisingly, dawdled.
President Ford could release more money, in effect, to all campaigns by signing the new federal election law, which arrived at the White House last night. But he's not expected to act on it until sometime next week.
Eventually, Ford signed it. But for a time, that gamesmanship helped him strangle the Reagan campaign. And it caused all kinds of strange fluctuations on the Democratic side as candidates battled to catch up to Jimmy Carter. Now again, that was a side story. the ultimate effect of the new campaign finance rules and the court decision went far beyond the momentary fortunes of any single candidate, as our guest Mark Johnson will explain.
This was the jump start of a new era in American politics.
That's when we come back.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, the automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy explains how Betterment's technology helps investors better understand and save on taxes.
So taxes are a real cost of investing, as are fees. Understanding your after-tax, after-fee returns is really what's important for investors. An example would be when you buy and sell securities frequently, you can pay a lot of taxes because short-term capital gains, meaning I bought it and I sold it fairly quickly, have higher taxes than long-term capital gains. Our technology in particular will tell you what the tax implication of a particular move you'd like to make is going to be before you make that move so that you're making it with full transparency.
Learn more at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance not guaranteed. Support for NPR and the following message come from Rosetta Stone, the perfect app to achieve your language learning goals no matter how busy your schedule gets. It's designed to maximize study time with immersive 10-minute lessons and audio practice for your commute. Plus, tailor your learning plan for specific objectives like travel. Get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off and unlimited access to 25 language courses. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR. This message comes from Schwab. With Schwab investing themes, it's easy to invest in ideas you believe in, like online music and videos, artificial intelligence, electric vehicles, and more. Schwab's research uncovers emerging trends, then their technology curates relevant stocks into over 40 themes to choose from. Schwab investing themes is not intended to be investment advice or a recommendation of any stock or investment strategy. Visit schwab.com/thematic investing.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Vuori, a new perspective on performance apparel. Clothing designed with premium fabrics, built to move in, styled for life. For 20% off your first purchase, go to Vuori.com/NPR.
In this country, some truths aren't self-evident. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of stories as wide-ranging and real as the people who tell them, we celebrate the Black experience for all its soul and richness. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get podcasts.
In the months and years after the Supreme Court's Buckley decision, outside spending in campaigns skyrocketed. Printers buzzed, saturating voters with direct mail. The new right grew in power. We've talked about it, how it served as a new form of media, and its role in electing Ronald Reagan. But Mark Johnson explains how the combination of the Buckley decision and the new right did far more than that. It changed the terrain for every single race for federal office in the country. And we can see that through the lens of the race for Senate in 1980 and the role of one of the biggest new right groups.
People who think about 1980 always think about the Reagan landslide. The backstory of that is what happens in the rest of politics in 1980. And that's the story I've tried to tell based upon these four Senate races in that were particularly targeted by this group, NCPAC, the National Conservative Political Action Committee, run by a young guy named Terry Dolan. Dolan was very open in his comments to reporters saying, we're going to do things that the Federal Elections Commission and the Congressional Act never thought possible.
Hypothetically, there could be two candidates in the state of Idaho running their campaigns and 20,000 different interest groups running independent campaigns around them.
So some of these groups that were activist groups that were really looking over the horizon a little bit realized that the Buckley decision really took all the sideboards down and they could really run into new territory, and they certainly did. These four Senate races, Frank Church in Idaho, George McGovern in South Dakota, Birch Bayh in Indiana, all very senior, generally very well-respected members of the United States Senate. And the fourth member of that crew was the more junior, John Culver from Iowa, So NCPAC targets all of these guys in 1980 and runs independent expenditure campaigns against each one of them. The same basic issue mix, same use of direct mail, same use of this almost exactly the same attack ads against them.
With so many problems facing us at home, we need a senator and not a globetrotter.
They had Richard Viguerie. They had the database. They knew how to mobilize those low information voters. But what changed and what has lasting impact is how those independent expenditure campaigns came to define each of these congressional races. You know, somebody in Oklahoma could send in a check to NCPAC to target a guy in the United States Senate in Idaho or in Indiana. So that served to nationalize congressional and Senate elections ever since.
So you're saying that was new. You're saying that was new. That
it was absolutely new with NCPAC. A guy like Frank Church in Idaho, you know, very senior member of the Democratic Party, elected first time in 1956. He runs basically a local campaign every year until 1980, when he is faced with having to respond to these vast amounts of money, vast for the time, kind of puny by today's standards, but it seemed like a lot of money at the time. It's coming into the state and attacking him in radio and television and newspaper advertising and direct mail. So he has to run a campaign that is focused not on his constituents in Idaho and even the ones who disagreed with him ideologically, but, you know, some citizen in Virginia or Texas or Alabama that is saying, I want to beat this guy in Idaho. So you're seeing that now in every single U.S. Senate race. Every Senate race becomes a national contest for which party is going to control the Senate. So it's really made these congressional races, which I would argue before about 1976 or 1980 for sure, tended to focus more on, well, not exactly local issues, but at least state-level issues. What legislator was most in touch with our farm economy? Which legislator was most in touch with bringing home the bacon for a dam or a irrigation project? Now they became issues about, well, is Frank Church helping bail out New York City, which was bankrupt? Abortion became a huge issue at that very same period, a nationalized issue that had basically not been an issue when these campaigns existed before all the outside money started to flow into these states.
Well, you know, I mean, speaking of NCPAC, there's a letter that we cite in the series. People hear a quote from it. It's against new textbooks. And what it says is, your tax dollars are being used to teach our children that cannibalism, wife swapping, and murder of infants are acceptable behavior. That letter is from NCPAC. It's a Viguerie letter. It's from NCPAC, and it's signed by Senator Jesse Helms, the firebrand conservative who was also tangled up with the new right. And it just seems to me like a perfect example of what you're describing, and the kinds of inflammatory, apocalyptic mail that was being sent around the country. So a protest could be happening in West Virginia against textbooks, and all of a sudden this is being nationalized, and maybe it's being used against Senator Church or Senator McGovern or Senator By or one of these other places that they're not used to having this sort of outside spending.
Yeah, no, in not in their defense, but maybe in defense of their naivete, they were not prepared at all for the kinds of assaults that they were subjected to in 1980. And have become routine now in our politics.
One of the big upsets where Frank Church, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, has been ousted by Steve Sims, who had the backing of the moral majority. John Culver was ousted by Chuck Grassley. Again, it was a case of the moral majority and NCPAC, the conservatives, targeting Culver. In fact, they have done an extraordinary job. Let's move on now to Alabama.
One of the themes that I think I try to look at in Landslide is going back to the relatively recent past and looking at changes that happened in the relatively recent past that maybe we're not all that familiar with, and that then we take for granted the new paradigm that's created based on that change. Money in politics and today's political finance ecosystem seems to me to be one of those great things where the era that we live in, the amount of money, where the money comes from, and how it operates is just absolutely a sea change from where it was not only a couple of decades ago, but a half century ago. How ahistorical would you say that this moment that we're in now is?
Well, yeah, I think it's an unprecedented moment that we're now in. And I think you've said it very well. I think it is an absolute sea change from the way American politics operated before the Buckley decision and the subsequent decisions, Citizens United included. It's a system ripe for corruption and ripe for the kind of dysfunctional, grievance-based politics that have become so endemic. And if you like the system now, then I guess you probably favor all of these changes that have happened. If you're kind of concerned about the trajectory we're on, then you have to go back to the origin story. And a great part of the origin story is these vast amounts of money in politics.
Mark C. Johnson is a historian who is a fellow at the Mansfield Center at the University of Montana. Mark, thank you so much for talking with me.
Ben, it's been a great pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to this bonus episode. And if you've enjoyed Landslide and would like another full season, please tell others about the series, rate us, and sign up for our mailing list at nuancedtales.com. It helps. This bonus episode was produced by me, Ben Bradford, with additional engineering from Matt Bradford, who also composed and produced the music. Landslide is a production of Nuanced Tales in partnership with WFAE, distributed by the NPR Network.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Allianz Travel Insurance. Don't get caught without emergency medical coverage on an international trip. Learn how Allianz Travel Insurance can protect your trip from the unexpected at AllianzTravelInsurance.com.
Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Learning. IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid, no matter the age or personality. Get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when you sign up today at IXL.com/NPR.
What does it mean to be Black in America? In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of stories as varied, nuanced, and dynamic as Black experiences, you'll hear it means everything. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.